Hi everyone. I hope you're well. I can't believe it's Wednesday night and I finally have a minute to be able to record my sermon from this past Shabbat. And so I hope you enjoy it. I do think that it's still something very apropos, being that we speak about Purim, the upcoming holiday. So here goes. Last Sunday, at the Oscars, a Jewish director won the award for Best International Film for his film on Rudolf Hess, the commandant of Auschwitz during the Holocaust. And of all things, the director chose to criticize Israel during his speech. And he said, and I quote, "Our film shows where dehumanization leads at its worst. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people, whether the victims of October 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack in Gaza." He doesn't want his Judaism and the memory of the Holocaust to be used to justify what he calls the occupation. He blamed the occupation, meaning Israel, for the troubles of both Jews and Arabs. This is what is being said by a Jew, no less, in one of the most important events watched the world over. Naturally, the next day, my entire social media feed is filled with people expressing shock, anger, talking about it. Even people who find themselves on his side of the political aisle were upset. Those people argued that even if he's right, it's not the time to make such statements. When anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish hatred is rampant and Jews are under attack all over the world, this is not the time to start discussing politics and what we believe and not believe. But the fact is, and I'm not telling you something you don't know already, this is nothing new in Jewish history. We've experienced similar things time and again. I want to talk today about the Purim Oscars. So the Talmud has an entire tractate that's dedicated to the story of Purim. It's called the Tractate of Megillat Esther. And this tractate describes an interaction that took place between the great Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his students when the holiday of Purim approached. The students came to Rabbi Shimon and they said, "Why? Why were the Jewish people sentenced to annihilation?" Now, this wasn't a question about Haman. This wasn't anti-Judaism as something that they needed to explain to them. It was more of a spiritual question, a question about God. What they were really asking is, why did God allow the circumstances to come to a place where the Jewish people are threatened with total annihilation? Why did God allow Haman to orchestrate such a terrible plan? Now, instead of answering the question, Rabbi Shimon did something that is, I would say, unparalleled in the entire Talmudic literature. He posed a question back to them. Today, that's become very Jewish, answer a question with a question. But in the Talmudic times, usually you went to the rabbi and the rabbi had an answer for you. And he says to them, "You answer." Now, usually the Talmud records questions from students and answers from teachers. It's not a therapy session where we want to know how everybody feels. It's a unique instance. And here, Rabbi Shimon chooses to return the question to them. And so the students suggest a famous answer. They say, "It's because they had enjoyed the feast of that evil man," referring to Ahasuerus, the king of Persia at the time. Now, let's go back to the Purim story and try to give some context to all of this. In the beginning of the Purim story, it opens up with a scene. King Ahasuerus hosts a massive party for the entire capital city of Shushan, and he invites the Jewish residents of Shushan as well to join the party. In fact, not only were the Jewish people invited, but they're actually treated quite cordially. The king arranged for kosher food to the highest degree, food that Mordechai, the leader of the Jewish people of the time, he himself would approve of. So what's so evil about the party? It sounds like the king is making a party, and for a change, he's actually thinking about the Jewish people, inviting the Jews. Why were the Jews punished for attending the party? What I want to get to today is the backstory, because it's connected to this week's Torah portion, this past week's Torah portion, even this coming Torah portion to a certain extent. The Talmud says that one of the attractions at the feast was a display of the vessels from the Holy Temple. Those vessels were plundered from Jerusalem by the Babylonians. And this was very important imagery because it was displayed to demonstrate the eternal destruction of Jerusalem versus the power and success of Persia. There was an entire history here. Before the destruction of the first temple, the prophet Jeremiah prophesied that after 70 years of exile, God would return the Jewish people to their land. Now, this deadline was apparently known to the Babylonians, and actually, it weighed down on their plans. They always wondered, what if the prophecy was right? Would they actually lose their empire? Now, in those days, emperors and leaders were very superstitious, and they were worried about anyone usurping them. So, 50 years after the temple was destroyed, there was a feast held by the great king Belshazzar. He was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, who was the leader, the king of Babylonia that destroyed the first temple. It was his army that destroyed the first temple. So he wanted to celebrate the victory over Cyrus of Persia and of Darius of Media. And he celebrated with no less than 1,000 ministers. Suddenly, as he celebrated, it occurred to him that the prophecy had failed. Somehow, he had miscalculated, and he arrived at a conclusion that 70 years had already passed, and the Jewish people would remain in exile forever. The calculation was actually interesting, because he calculated not from the time the temple was destroyed, but from the time that his father, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken over the leadership of Babylonia. That's how he calculated it. So it was like 3319, and this was 50 years later, so this would have been 3379, something like that. The Jewish God had forsaken them. The Jewish God had forsaken the Jewish people. And Babylon would reign supreme, and this was the celebration of Belshazzar. In a drunken celebration, he commanded that all the vessels from the Holy Temple be brought out, and he began to eat and drink out of them. Imagine the sight of this king of Babylonia or Persia drinking out of the holy vessels. The story continues that a hand appears on the wall and writes a cryptic sentence in blood red ink. Mina, Mina, Tekel, Upharsin. The handwriting is on the wall. Literally, the writing is on the wall. Perhaps this is the origin of the statement, the writing is on the wall. When Belshazzar saw this, he was incredibly frightened. And he calls all his advisors and his interpreters to start interpreting it for him. In those days, if you were a leader, you were a nobody if you didn't have an interpreter. Everyone had an interpreter, a stargazer, somebody who can explain things. Nobody had an explanation. He's literally shaking from fear. His wife says to him, Belshazzar, call Daniel the prophet. Daniel was a Jew. This is the book of Daniel. And he has served as the advisor for his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel interprets a sentence that God is counting the years of your reign and weighing your deeds. And he will slice your kingdom. That Belshazzar was going to lose his seat and his kingdom would fall to Persia and Media. Hearing such drastic news, he became paranoid. And you probably can recognize this story because it's similar to what Pharaoh did in Egypt. And he said they should close the palace doors and they should be locked at night and nobody should be allowed in, even if they claimed to be the king. He was worried that somebody was going to come and kill him. He seemed to have forgotten that the outhouse was beyond the gates. And in the middle of the night, he exited to relieve himself. Also, it was common in those days for leaders to go relieve themselves because they would make themselves as deities. They didn't have to go to the bathroom during the day. Pharaoh did the same thing in Egypt. And so they would go at night when no one was looking. Anyway, he's coming back from relieving himself and he's accosted by his own guards. And in the dark, they didn't recognize him. And he said, Willie, I'm the king, I'm the king. And you know what they said? He said, even if they say they're the king, they got so scared that Belshazzar was going to do something to them if they didn't do something about this guy who claims he's the king, and they chopped off his head. He's literally killed in the confusion. This is the story that's told in the book of Daniel. After such a dramatic story, and after the destruction of the temple, nobody dared touch the vessels. Nobody touched the vessels. They felt like it's possible that it's because of him taking up the vessels of this party that he ended up getting killed. Until the Purim story. Until the opening of the Megillah. At the beginning of the Purim story, Ahasuerus arrives at the conclusion that Belshazzar had miscalculated. It was 20 years later exactly. And according to his own calculations, the 70 years of the Babylonian exile were now actually over. Again, he made a mistake, and we can go through this a different time in the history of these mistakes. The Jewish people were still in exile. So this time, it really meant that God would never redeem them again, according to Ahasuerus. And again, to celebrate this milestone, he ordered the vessels of the temple be brought out. Now Mordechai, the leader of the Jewish people, begged the people not to participate, not to go to an event that celebrates the demise of the Jewish people. But of course, the Jews had an excuse for everything. What was their excuse? Everyone else is going. Why shouldn't I go? Really? I wish one thing. I wish many things, but one thing in specific with regards to what's going on in the world today. I wish independence and critical thinking. Somehow, the world has become groupthink. It's become too...
We'll be back after a quick break.
Are you tired of swiping right on every dating app out there and still getting nowhere?
Are you convinced that you'll forever be alone, surrounded by nothing but cats and empty takeout containers?
Hi, I'm Aliza Ben Shalom, the host of the new show, Jewish Matchmaking, which you can find on Netflix.
And I'm the Love Rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Bernath, and we're inviting you to join us for Matchmaker Matchmaker.
Each week, we'll answer one of your pressing relationship questions, from how to get over your ex to how to deal with your partner's annoying habits.
So if you're ready to laugh, cry, or maybe even find love, then tune in to Matchmaker Matchmaker, and it's available now wherever you listen to your podcasts. Why shouldn't I go if everyone else is going? That's why should I say that? Well, everyone else is saying that. One of the great gifts that our ancestors have given us, one of the great gifts of the Jewish people is independent and critical thinking. We never just take things as they are. We always challenge them. And I think that's a good thing. You can believe whatever you want. It's no one's business to tell you what to believe or what to think and how to think it. But my wish to you and to everyone else is that you should think that on your own. And not because someone else told you, or not because you're trying to follow a certain political stance. Make a decision for yourself. That's my wish. So many Jews during that time, the time of that party, they just went because everyone else was going. Why not? They would say things like, he's such a good king for the Jews. And the truth is that at that time, the Jews had full civil rights. And they were very integrated into society. Many of them in Persia became quite successful. So when the king invited them, they felt compelled to attend. How many Jews went? The Midrash says that 18,500 Jews attended that feast. The king, Ahasuerus, walks in, dressed in the clothing of the high priest. He ate and drank out of the temple vessels even more than Belshazzar. Interestingly enough, as punishment for desecration, God caused the king to kill his wife Vashti in a drunken stupor. Vashti was the daughter of Belshazzar, that king before who had used the temple vessels before. And this story, I wish at some point we have time to go through more details of the story, because there's so many amazing parts of the story. I may try before Purim. And if you want this, please let me know. Maybe before Purim, I'll go through the Purim story, because it's fascinating. The story is interesting, and it makes a compelling case for what's wrong about that feast. That feast was celebrating the destruction of the Jewish people. And obviously, as Mordechai said, it was inappropriate for the Jews to attend. But the question still stands. Was that enough for the Jewish people to deserve annihilation, going back to the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his students? Did the Jews really deserve to die for attending the feast? I thought about this a number of times over the years, and the Rebbe has a revolutionary response. The Rebbe says that very often we make a mistake of attributing bad events to divine punishment. But more accurately, we should understand that in many cases, it's a result of our own behavior. When we eat spoiled food, we get food poisoning. That's not a punishment. That's cause and effect. It's a simple physical consequence. Cause and effect exists in our world because it exists in the spiritual universe as well, as many things that exist in our world because they exist in the spiritual universe as well. Our sages say that the Jewish people are compared to a sheep among 70 wolves. How do we survive? They say that we survive only in the merit of the great shepherd, of God himself, who shields us and protects us. This is our natural, our normal state. Occasionally, the Jewish people succeed, even in the environment of the 70 wolves. For a moment, we begin to believe that the wolves like us, they respect us. They even welcome us into their club and they give us Oscars. When that happens, we begin to think that our own achievements will keep us safe, that we no longer need the constant watch of a shepherd. We're big kids. We can take care of ourselves now. But at that moment, when we declare in front of the world our independence from God, what do? We submit ourselves to the whims of nature. The decree of annihilation, which followed the participation in the feast, was not a punishment. It was a natural reaction. The Jewish people had removed themselves from God's iron dome. They were so convinced that their safety in the Persian kingdom that they no longer needed God's miraculous protection. Suddenly, when the 70 wolves woke up, the Jews were left at their mercy. Sound familiar? So, what does this have to do with me and you? We can go down that road. I'm not going to go down that road. I'm going to go down this road. When Mordechai heard about the decree, you know what he did? He gathered 22,000 Jewish children in the capital, and he studied Torah with them. Now, other efforts were made to stop the decree as well. The adults fasted 3 days and three nights. That's the origin of the fast of Esther that we're going to be observing tomorrow. This year we observe it tomorrow, Thursday, even though Purim is Saturday and Sunday, because it's one of those fasts that doesn't override Shabbat. And so usually it's the day before Purim, but this year it's going to be tomorrow, Thursday. And so the adults fasted 3 days and three nights, and Esther, of course, approaches the king. But the truth is, that's not what changed the reality. The Midrash says that God suddenly asked, "What are the voices of the young kids that I hear?" Those are the voices of the Jewish children praying for the salvation of the Jewish people. That's what the angels told him. And when God heard those prayers, he tore the decree of annihilation and chose to save the Jewish people. This past week, we concluded the book of Shemot, and we declared together, Chazak, Chazak, v'nitchazek. Be strong, and let's be strengthened. We're good. Now, this week, we start Vayikra, which is interesting. Most students, children, when they go to school for the first time, they study Vayikra. That's the first book that they study. And anyone that is acquainted with the story of the Jewish people knows that we've gone through difficult situations, maybe even more difficult than the one we're going through now. There have been Jews throughout the ages that have rejected their Judaism. There have been Jews throughout the ages that have behaved poorly towards their Jewish brethren for all sorts of reasons. Whether to ingratiate themselves in the eyes of the entire world or to ensure they don't get thrown out of the elite clubs or just maybe simply to make money, whatever it is. Regardless of what the reason is, the Jewish people have not only survived, but thrived. And today, we find ourselves once again in a situation, by and large, that's far better than ever before. And so what I say to you today is the children. That's what Mordechai did. That's what the Jewish people have done. Talk to the children. Pray with the children. Tell the children to do a mitzvah. God listens to the purity of the child. They don't have an agenda. They don't have any reason. A child can be completely altruistic. And so we turn to the children today. And we say, be strengthened. Be strong, be strong. Pray. Do another mitzvah. If you have a child that you are caring for, if you're a parent of a young child, this is a great opportunity not to talk to them about what's going on in the world, to encourage them to be more Jewish, to raise them a little more Jewish. That is, I believe, the message of Purim and the story. And now we're going to go from Purim into Pesach, and it's a story of Pesach too. We have to tell our children the story that happened to us when we left Egypt, the story that happened to us when we were almost annihilated by the wicked Haman. This is the story, not necessarily that we tell them. We tell it to them by allowing them to be critical thinkers. I'm going to talk about this more when it comes to Pesach. But the Passover Seder is supposed to be a typical night in a Jewish home. That's the point of it. And the entire Seder is surrounded around critical thinking, independent thought, getting the kids to ask questions. In a world that people think religion is about, you just do. We have always taught the world critical thinking. We've always taught the world to ask questions. Don't just accept. But after you're done asking, we don't ask because for the sake of asking. We ask because of a genuine curiosity. A curiosity that will never, ever stop. We'll constantly be curious. That is the secret. And while we're curious, we also pray. We pray with our voice, and we do a mitzvah. A mitzvah comes from the word safta. It connects us to a higher power. There are 613 options, gifts that God gave us to be able to connect with Him. And we can just take one or two or three, even just one. Simple. Doesn't have to be complicated. Put a little bit of charity in a box every single day. Doesn't have to be thousands of dollars, 5 cents, in another box. Light the Shabbat candles before Shabbat this week. Put on the tefillin in the morning. Put on the mezuzah on the door. Simple mitzvot. Mitzvot that the kids could see and experience. And those are the mitzvahs that we're going to do. We do them today the same way we've done them for thousands of years. We do them today because the hostages, 134 of them, are stuck. Who knows what's going on with them? Almost 6 months, and there's no word, no sign. The world should be in an uproar about this. For sure, the Jewish community has been and continues to be in an uproar about it. But we do those mitzvahs because they can't. And Hashem should merit that before Purim, that we can truly celebrate together in a way that we have never celebrated before. That the feast of Ahasuerus and the feast of Belshazzar, they should be nothing compared to our feast, our great feast. The feast of having our hostages back home, the feast of peace, the feast of Mashiach, the feast of a time when all of the swords are turned to plowshares, when everything is for goodness and for kindness, and may it be today.
Hi, Rabbi Bernath here. I have some great news for you. My popular 4-week course, Kabbalah for Everyone, is available right now for free for the next 50 people who download it. All you have to do is go to www.theloverabbi.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and you're going to see the download button right there. In this course, I talk about the Kabbalistic secrets to relationships, to wealth, to happiness, and balance. This special offer has been dedicated in loving memory of Elie Dorfman. I look forward to hearing from you and hope you enjoy the course. Now on to today's episode.